Well, I hope we have some fun tonight. The topic of that I wanted to address, I put the title actually on the piece of paper over there. I'll say everything that's there, and if you can't read it, you can write it down later if you want. But so the title is Discerning, Comparing, Belittling, or a Sleep Mind, a Report Card or a Scorecard. That's the title. Discerning, Comparing, Belittling, or a Sleep Mind, a Report Card or a Scorecard. And maybe the subtitle, Working Directly with Mental Formations and Thoughts as a Path to Wisdom. Practical applications of the third and fourth foundations of mindfulness. So that's what we're going to be looking at. We're going to be looking at those words and those qualities as they arise in our experience, in our minds. I'm going to talk about how those experiences when they arise in my mind. And I want to talk about it in the context of exploring the contents of mind, which is sort of the third foundation. When these qualities are manifesting, if you know they're manifesting, that's part of the work of the third foundation of mindfulness. Again, first foundation, pay attention to your body. Second foundation, you pay attention if what's arising is pleasant or unpleasant. And then the third great area for paying attention is, okay, now what's going on in this mind? What's happening in there? What qualities are manifesting? Is there greed? Is there aversion? But I want to pick up, and we've talked about those and the hindrances, but I want to pick up specifically on these qualities that might arise in mind. So I wanted to say a few words about how I go about preparing a talk. The reason I wanted to say that, when we started doing this program, Sheila and I, Sheila would make a point every time we'd get together to plan. She'd say, you know, whatever we're going to talk about, we would decide what things we're going to talk about. But she would always say to me, like, but whatever we talk about, we should also sort of fold into it some didactic stuff about how do you do this, what you're doing, you know, sort of make it transparent since it's a teacher training program. And so that's so I thought I'd start a little bit with how and why I picked this topic, but that's the first step. If you're going to teach something, is to pick a topic to talk about. I mean, I guess you could just get up and ramble as an option, but we think it's a good idea to pick something to talk about. We talked about, okay, what are you going to talk about? What are you going to talk about? So I pick a topic, and obviously I think the topic should be relevant. It should be relevant to the work that's going on. And in this case, I wanted it to be relevant to the work of this training program, having something to do with teaching. And I wanted it to be relevant to the fact that this experience is probably going to be going on a lot for you this week. So it seemed like it wasn't my first choice of topics, actually. There are things I'm more interested in talking about and more passionate about. But when I thought about what would be relevant, what would be really helpful, and I had given one version of this talk recently, too, so it's a little bit fresher in my mind. I just started paying attention to this. So I thought this would probably be a good choice for tonight. So it may not be the most, I don't actually, when I went over the material, it's not the most profound stuff I've ever thought about or tried to make clear, but maybe the most useful thing I'm going to share here. That's definitely a possibility. I'm not glad you're laughing. Later, I'll be glad you're laughing. I'm going to talk about humor later, but yeah. And then I used to have a pattern. It's a little less true now, but I used to have a pattern after I picked a topic as I tried to see if there was a story I could tell, because that would fill up a really good block of time. It would be entertaining. They had to be relevant as well, but I do that a little bit less, but I did find a little story for today. And then the last few years, I've been trying to add a song, too. Maybe more than the last few years. I've tried to see if there's a song. And those things, maybe telling a story and doing a song, those are some of the particular things of my style. It's not for everybody. So that's another point I want to make. You have to develop your own style. I'm going to come back to that. And I think it's really important to teach something you know about. So it's not just a topic that's relevant. It has to be a topic that's relevant that also you've done some work with. And by that, in this practice, what we're talking about means something you've actually thought about in your practice and put practice time into it and tried to see. So it's not just about relaying information about the practice that you know other people are talking about, but it's information that was relevant to you and that in your practice you started working on so that you had your own realizations of the material. So I really like when I teach from my, most of the examples I use are examples that come when I'm sort of either from examples from on retreat where my mindfulness and attention is really honed, or examples in life but where I'm really paying attention, where sort of the tools of mindfulness were being used, and then I saw something, I realized the truth of something that I heard about and know is part of the teaching. But then I think it's good to be prepared. And sometimes I'm more prepared than other times. You may have noticed I finished going over my notes at 7:19. So luckily Jordan had some announcements to make. And then sometimes I pick a topic that I'm interested in and that I'm sort of working on myself where I want to go deeper. So I've tried twice now to give a talk on karma because I think it's a huge, important part of the teaching of mindfulness, and certainly important as it came from the East. And it's one of the topics. So when I go on retreat and I listen, I go on retreat frequently, and I listen to all the teachers. They give amazing talks. And on lots of retreats I go on, somebody will give a karma talk. And every other talk, I'm just like hanging on the edge of my chair. It's amazing. And then they give a karma talk, and it's like, and I scratch my head. And I was like, oh, I don't believe that. It's the only thing they talk about. That's not my experience. But I'm interested in this. So sometimes I've done talks on karma, and really, I've just sort of opened up a few little aspects of it. I think it's still something I want to get deeper into. So sometimes I pick a topic for that reason. So for tonight, I thought this topic would be relevant, and I did have I did have some sort of appeal to it. I heard a talk with this title, except not so fancied up. It was Judging versus Discerning Mind by Corrado Penza. I think either he gave that talk on a retreat. Joanna has sat with Corrado a couple of times, and either he gave the talk on the retreat. Yeah, okay, so she probably told me about that talk, and I listened to it. I listened to that talk. I don't remember a lot of the particulars of what he said, but the topic was really interesting to me, and it made a lot of sense to want to explore the difference between judging mind and discerning mind, because discerning mind is great. It's not that we shouldn't think this is one way and this is another way, and this may be there's some benefit to doing it this way, and that's not a bad quality. So I knew there was something there, and he really explained it from a really interesting point of view, but it was just the general topic I really liked. I really liked that he opened that up. We want to be able to distinguish and differentiate what are helpful mind states. There are some mind states that are helpful, and there's some that are not helpful, and we want to be able to discern that. So, and that's not a judgment. That's different than judging, oh, I shouldn't have this, shouldn't be this way. So thankfulness versus aversion. I want to know when my mind is experiencing thankfulness, because that's, in my experience, that is a more wholesome mind state. And I want to know when my mind has aversion, I see that's not so helpful. And that's not a judgment about those things. That's a discernment, in my opinion. And tonight I'm going to ask you for your opinion on a lot of these things, too, so I'll get to that. So we want to be able to make discernments over the things we do in this world, too. So, I notice that without saying whether drinking alcohol is good or bad, it's not about a judgment about it, but I do notice that on nights when I drink alcohol, the next day I have a little bit of an emotional hangover. Not so much physical, but like I'm a little shorter tempered, a little less patient. So that's a discernment to see that, not a judgment about whether one should or shouldn't drink alcohol. There's a discernment there. So we want to have discernments in our mind, we want to see how to have discernments out in the world about what things work in the world. We have to make discernments about should I take this job, should I not take this job, who should we vote for. We want to make, it's important to make discernments in the world. And to see where are those discernments coming out of wisdom, and where is it judgment instead. We want to be able to know what to do when we feel like somebody is criticizing us. So we want to be able to discern what are wholesome responses and where is judgment coming in. So that was the general topic I had decided to talk about, and I thought we'd all be working on comparing mind during this retreat. Maybe you noticed it already started when Dan spoke today. You know, just check inside. Was there some comparing going on already when Dan spoke? You know. So I wanted to add a category, though. So originally I was going to call just comparing versus discerning mind. So I want to talk about judgment for a little bit. And I intentionally decided to call judgment in the title. I called it belittling. I did that. Probably you might notice already. I did that already, so I can have a D, a C, a B, and an A. Right. And I'll get to that. But belittling. Just if you hear belittling, it's judgment. I'll probably use both terms. And I thought it was a little bit more pejorative than judgment is. So that was good. I sort of wanted to get to that point too a little bit. So I want to start with an example. I'm trying to take a somewhat mild example from my relationship with Joanna. Here's an experience. Joanna looks at a dish in the drying rack, and she says to me, "There's still some food on it." Now, I might think that she's judging or criticizing me. Right? I might have that thought. I confess, sometimes I have that thought. Okay, so now we're going to get a little more interactive on this presentation. So I want you to sort of rate. This is a rating, a scorecard. You're going to participate, you know, a lot, and from now on, a lot of the night. And you're not going to do your ratings out loud. I'll sort of compare. I'll sort of say some of mine out loud. There will be comparing going on too. We're intentionally using comparing. It happens anyway. So why not make it explicit? You know, and look at it. So you won't give your answers out loud, but I will give you some time. Short, quick. So it's going to be sort of reactive, so I'll give you a little bit of time. So let's just start with that one. So when Joanna said, "There's still some food on this plate." What do you think? Was that a discernment? Was that comparing? Was that belittling? By asleep, I mean, I didn't explain asleep. So for this part of the talk, asleep means all the things that go on in your mind that you didn't notice. It just means the thoughts that go through your mind that you didn't, they just happened, but you didn't really pay any attention to them happening. So in that comment, you know, there's still food on their plate. Is that a discernment? Is that comparing? Is that a judgment? So you don't know. I mean, you can't know, and there's not enough information there for you to know. It'll be easier to know when it's your own mind's thing coming up with these things. You'll have a little more information to work with about what these things are. But so I just want to, we're just sort of working on getting the terms out. Whether that was, when Joanna said that, whether that was a discernment, whether that was a judgment or criticism, that depends on all sorts of things, all sorts of things. It could be any of those things at any given moment. Depends a lot on what's going on inside of her. Okay, and my thought, okay, Joanna is criticizing me. So is that a discernment or a judgment? Again, you don't know for sure, and neither do I. It was not such a complete discernment. There's too many things that go on. That we have history. We have. I have my own nature about how I hear certain things because of certain reasons. There's a good chance that was not a wise, just a complete, untainted wise discernment. So noticing what's going on in the mind is sort of the third foundation. And noticing how those things arise, when they come, when they go, what are the contributing factors to the arising of that, that's sort of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. where wisdom can arise. So when I say we're going to be exploring these states as they arise in the mind, exploring means we're going to observe their arising, try to observe their passing, or watch the arising and passing of judgment or comparing when it happens. And when that happens, see if you can drop into your body too, feel your body, know what you're feeling, and try to see what feelings correlate with which mind states and with these states arising. That's all part of the process. So now you actually know that. That's the whole talk in some ways. And that's what you can do. But I'm gonna just sort of make it more explicit. So I'm gonna share a number of thoughts tonight, and I'm gonna have you sort of rate them. You'll have a few seconds to do it. So I'm just going back to where I started about, you know, how do I make a talk? What's some of the didactic issues for teaching? So one of the things, besides picking the topic and preparing what I want to say, is I want to make what I'm sharing interesting and engaging. And so that's why I came up with this approach, this idea to make it sort of interactive and engaging. So I want to share real examples of thoughts that I actually have had and have you rate them. So, and I want to use examples from my actual life because I think that's a good idea. You might not think that's a good idea, to share actual examples from your real life when you're teaching. So, and that includes, I want to share examples from my own life of when I was grasping or confused. And so for example, if I want to teach the idea that grasping causes suffering, so when I do that, I try to give a real example of where some situation where I was definitely grasping, and I talk about how I was grasping, and I talk about my own suffering that happened in it. So that's what I think is good to do. That's a practice I try to use. So that's what I'm talking about tonight. And as I'm preparing the talk, the thought certainly went through my mind. I wonder if Joanna and Sheila and Jordan will like what I share in this talk. That arose in my mind. Probably similar things will arise in your mind. Maybe not. We'll see. So I'm sort of wonder if they'll think it was a good choice and a good presentation. So what kind of thought is that? And that thought goes through my mind. And so if you think that's comparing mind, you'd give it a C. I think it's not discernment. Like that there's not so much discernment in that thought. There's definitely comparing. So when I have that thought, I wonder what they think. I'm sort of comparing, you know, what I'm going to talk about, how I'm going to present it, what they talk about, how they present things. So for me, it certainly had some comparing in it. And then these are not the only qualities one will notice and that you'll notice. So because when that thought went through my mind and I think about what I'm feeling in that moment, underneath there's a feeling of, you know, nafshi cholat ahavatecha. I want to be loved. You know, I want love and approval. I don't think those are the same thing, by the way. But I want love and approval. The feeling, there's some neediness. And that thought goes through in my mind. If I sort of check it out, there's some neediness. There's some aversion to the thought of not doing well, right? So that it can feel that. Yeah. And so that neediness is not the main topic for tonight, but it's underneath. That's what you want to see. That's underneath some of these other things. So I wanted to be able to have some fun by using these letter grades too. That we could grade it, you know, D, C, B, A. And so as I say those things, you can sort of grade my thing. You can grade your own thought about is what you think about what I said, is that a discernment or is that a judgment? And what kind of comparison is going on there? And you might fall asleep. So you might not pay any, you might space out. That'd be sort of an A, right? When we do this, in a certain way, we're shooting for a D average, right? That was, you know, I thought, oh, good, that'll wake everybody up. That'll get us thinking outside of the box, you know, you're not trying to get an A average, trying to get a D average. Oh, what does that mean, you know? and doing that, I'm trying to be funny. So that's like an, I mean, it's not, it's never good for a comedian to tell people how he's trying to make them laugh. You know, it's like a magician, they don't tell that how you do the trick, and it's like not good to watch a magician, they tell you how to do the trick. But I wanted to be funny somehow. I wanted this to be funny, to keep you engaged. So, the idea of keeping you engaged, I think, from a discerning point of view, that's a good idea, to try to keep you engaged. But being funny is not the only way to do that. And then, as I think about that, when I think about, if I think I want you to think I'm funny, what kind of thought is that? You know, I'm going into comparing mind, and there's a lot of self-involvement there. So the point is, the point of trying to make material funny is to make it engaging, not to have you think that I'm funny. That's a lot of selfing. But if you think it's funny, what I'm saying, and if you think it's funny to look at these thoughts, maybe when you look at these thoughts for yourself, you'll be able to have a sense of humor about it. That's a good idea. It doesn't really matter if you think I'm funny. It's just funny that this stuff goes on, you know. And sometimes it's really distressing, but, you know. And anyway, Sheila's funny when she talks, isn't she? Right? Okay, now, how would you rate that thought? Now, I'm not asking you to rate whether Sheila's funny. So if I say Sheila's funny, what do you think? Is that? That's okay. Who says it's not a discernment? Maybe that's a discernment. I think Sheila is funny. But, you know, so then it depends a lot. Again, it depends a lot on what's going on inside of me. If I'm feeling, and I have some of the things down there, we'll get to them. If I'm feeling insecure, then and I have that thought, then I'm comparing myself to her. If I'm feeling just really relaxed and not thinking about my presentation and listening to her and laughing, probably it's because it's funny. Probably it's actually, you know, that's probably a discernment that. Anyway, she is really funny. So I'm going back to this scorecard, report card, rating. I'm obviously only kidding about trying to get a D average. And it's not really, I use those terms, but we're not trying to have a scorecard. Because it's not about winning and losing. A scorecard is sort of about winning and losing. And then when I thought about it, report card's not so great either. Like, at least when I was in school, you know, the report card was supposed to be some sort of evaluative process, but it was sort of more like a scorecard, you know. And I think there were some years when I was young that where you didn't get letter grades, you know, and that helped a little bit, you know. But mostly I got caught up in the scorecard. I mean, I really, you know, I was concerned about my class rank in high school, you know. So it really was much more of a scorecard, you know. But what we're, so it's not about getting a D average, but what we are trying to do is be mindful, which in this case is the same as discerning. We're trying to be mindful, trying to be discerning about the nature of our thoughts. We're not trying to get them to be any different per se, except that when you are aware of the nature of your thoughts, they start to shift. But the practice itself is just really to be, to discern what, when we're not trying to per se get rid of comparing thoughts and belittling thoughts. We're trying to use this process to watch them arise. And so moments of discernment can be coexistent with moments of comparing and judging thought, as long as you're noticing, oh, there's comparing and judging thought going on. That's a discernment. I can't stand how much I'm comparing everybody. It's not a discernment about the judging. Now you're judging the judging. Right? So the bottom half of that sheet, I just want to explore the terms a little bit more so we can know what we're looking at and how to work with them. So discerning mind, I think that's in the middle of the page. So discerning mind sees things clearly as they are. Mindfulness, in some ways it coincides with mindfulness. Sees things clearly as they are. It's in the moment. The discerning mind is in the moment, settled and balanced. These are the places from which discernment can arise. When the mind is settled and balanced, receptive, humble. And we're going to talk about the opposite of humble when we get to the comparing mind. So, and the discerning mind, as much as possible, comes about when we're resting in what we've called in the, I think in the curriculum we studied it, the four divine abodes. So when those qualities are manifesting, when your heart mind space is full of peace, or joy, loving kindness, compassion, those are all things that lead to the mind being able to make discernments. And I want to talk about comparing and judging a little bit, because they're not exactly the same. Oftentimes they come together. So lots of times they happen at the same time, but not always. You can certainly compare without judging. So like when I started going to Spirit Rock and doing this practice, Sheila and I were certainly both working with Sylvia. That's why I went out there. So I would listen to these really great teachers at Spirit Rock. There'd usually be four or five teachers on a retreat, and they would each give these hour-long talks like this. And it was really clear that even though sometimes they were addressing the same topics, the way Sylvia presented was completely different than the other four teachers. So she would teach whatever she was teaching based on who she sat next to on the plane. That was a frequent one. And the conversation they had on the plane on the way to the retreat, you know. So she taught everything she needed to teach out of, at the starting place, was personal examples in her life. And the other teachers who gave great, profound talks. I'm not judging how good they were. The other talks were incredibly great, and they mostly started out with quotes from the sutta, and then they would move into, you know, brilliant things to say. But it was sort of really clear how different it was. That's comparing mine without any judging. I tell you, I loved all of the talks, but they were really different. Her style was really different than the other four. Would sort of be more or less coming from the same way of approaching material, and then Sylvia. But they were all great. So comparing isn't always judging. So I think with judging, I think I put this down with judging. Judging very quickly has layered onto the comparing better or worse. Right? So, you know, you can look at two windows, and this window is bigger than that window. That's just comparing. But better or worse is a whole other thing. So one example I had of that was the first summer I ran the retreat center called Elat Chaim. The program director was a dear friend, David Wolfblank, who died about 12 years ago in a car accident. He was a great guy, and we were really close. He was the program director along with Sue. Sue was the other program. The two of them were the program directors for that first summer at Elat Chaim. And we invited Ram Dass to come and teach that first summer. So it was great. Ram Dass was it was the first time I had met him in person. I actually wandered into a room. I was at UCLA when I was like 19, and I wandered into a room and saw this guy in white robes, and it was really weird, and I walked right out. Later I found out it was Ram Dass, but at that time I wasn't ready for it. But anyways, so David told me this really interesting story the first time he met Ram Dass. He told me this that week. So he said David was working at Esalen, which is a sort of a retreat center in the Bay in California with these incredible outdoor natural hot springs. And David was working there like as an intern or something. And Ram Dass came, and he said so. He was outside, and Ram Dass came down. He was going to the bath, and David said, "You know, I was excited to see Ram Dass." So I said to him, "The better baths are down that way." He said, Ram Dass looked at me and he said, "The better baths." That was the whole interaction, you know. And David was like blown away. He was like, what makes bath better? You know, it's like he was really pointing out something. It was actually quite profound, you know. And I found Ram Dass was so good at that. I mean, I don't know if it's because David told me that story, but every time I'd go up to Ram Dass to say something, and I'd realize how ridiculous what I was going to say was before it even came out. So just sort of looking at him, you know. And I think it's because he really was really grounded and centered, and it was like somehow it was quite amazing being around him. But the better baths, you know. But judging mind also brings baggage into the situation. Like when there's greed or aversion in the mind, you know, that leads to much more of a comparison and a judgment. When you have that baggage with that. So if I'm bored listening to one of the teachers, you know, which wasn't the case at Spirit Rock, but it could be the case you're listening to different teachers, and one of them, you're bored. You notice you're bored. You know, and the thought comes out, you know, the other one's a better teacher. That's a better teacher. But really what's going on is you're feeling uncomfortable, and then from there it goes into a judgment. And the judgment is sort of self-serving. It's trying to figure out what's going on so that you don't have to be bored. or if you particularly like a teacher, Joanna and I, this is sort of the flip side of that. So Joanna and I were teaching, we taught a two-year program, a little bit like this, but it was four retreats over 2 years. It was called the Jewish Meditation Advanced Training, Elat Chaim Advanced Meditation Program. And we taught it with Norman Fisher. The three of us taught with Norman Fisher. So we had and that was a two-year program, and each retreat was 7 days, and we each gave talks. And there were three teachers, which means, so I gave, in the course of that program, I gave eight of these talks like this. And Joanna gave eight talks, and Norman gave eight talks. And then we got, as opposed to far fewer here, far less chances to hear from us in this program. But in any case, so that was the format. We get to the final thing, like we're going to get to here on the last day. Maybe it wasn't the final one, maybe it was halfway through or something. It probably was halfway through for the comment to make sense, but we get to the end of the retreat, we always had a sharing. So one person at the end of the retreat says, you know, in the next retreat, would it be possible for Norman to teach more? how would you rate that thought first? Right? So there's certainly comparing going on. I felt like there was, I guess I felt like there was judgment going on, but you can't really count on that because I was hurt. I was feeling hurt. Maybe it wasn't the wisest thing one could say publicly. I mean, I probably had the thought, I'd like to hear Norman teach more. Not at that moment, but I like listening to Norman teach. But I probably wouldn't have said that out loud. I'd just go on the web and listen to Norman teach more. But still, it's like, you know, it's not that she was wrong to want to hear Norman teach more. He's a great teacher. So, you know, we listen to him. We listen to him in the car when we're driving. He's a friend of ours too. But he's a great teacher. You know, so, and this was about 12 years ago. I obviously still remember this experience. So when I have, when I run into this person, which I do from time to time. And they start saying something, it's not difficult for judging mind to arise, much more easily, because I'm bringing baggage, I'm bringing baggage into that situation. There's still some hurt feelings there. So more judging arises. But if you know, you see it and you work with it, it's not that it shouldn't happen. It's an interesting thing to try to teach this way, to give these talks, to give the teachings that you're going to do with each other. So one of the things Sylvia taught us, I think she probably said this to both of us at the same time, but one of the things she taught that I think is, you know, worth knowing about and keeping in mind is, so she teaches, you know, I started teaching with these groups of people. She teaches with very interesting groups of people. And sometimes she'll sit and she'll listen to the talk of one of the other teachers. It's like, you know, she said I could be very disappointed. Like, you know, what were they talking about? But she would say, you know, and then the very next day, somebody would come in for their one-on-one session and say, wasn't that the most brilliant thing you ever heard? You know, so not the same thing doesn't, you know, not everything we teach resonates equally with every person we teach it to. It's just the way it is. At the highest levels, at the lowest levels, it's just the way it is. And it's not personal. And there isn't a better or worse there. This really, this style resonates for this one. This message resonates for somebody else. So sometimes I have the thought about my own teaching. I have the thought, you know, I'm not that popular. I'm not a popular teacher. So how would you, okay, how would you rate that thought? But not out loud. When you're not doing it out loud. I'll do it. You figure it out in your head, but I'll do the out loud part. I don't want to know what you think out loud. No, I do, but privately we can do that. So, obviously there's comparing in there. The word popular makes no sense without comparing. If everybody was popular, nobody would be popular. Right away, so you can't say that. You can't have that thought without some sort of comparing. It doesn't mean anything. At least it seems to me it doesn't really mean anything without that. So there's certainly comparing there. But and maybe you thought there's a lot of self-judgment there, which there could be. That's a possibility. But doesn't bother me that much. You know, it's not really. It's not. I'm as popular as I'm popular. Some people like me. There are definitely, I have some students who really benefit, and that's enough. I do feel like that's enough. If some people like what I have to say, that's fine. I don't have a lot of negative self-judgment about that. And I don't have a lot of negative self-judgment generally as a default position. You could ask Joanna. You know, it's not... that's no better than having a lot of self-judgment. I mean, it's not, just look how many people come on retreat with me. I think it's sort of a fairly accurate statement, but it's not so, but, you know, you don't know for sure. There's not a 100% set in stone system. It's just good and interesting to think about these things. So judging mind also can be compulsive, it can be habitual. These are things to look for, compulsive, habitual, have reactive patterns. And judging mind is often filled with opinions, beliefs and views and opinions and attachments to opinions. So if you think something should be a certain way, and then something comes your way, and if you think it should be a certain way, then you're much more likely to have a judgment about it. So. One of the things that came to mind when I was thinking about this talk was, a talk at the JMTT should have Jewish sources. And, you know, so, but I didn't have initially. And then I went looking for some Jewish sources, and I wasn't going to use them either. But then I had this thought, I thought, oh, that's an interesting thought. Should have Jewish, you know, if you, now you start to judge the thing. So it does say in Pirkei Avot, 1:6. Judge every person favorably. I did look at all these things to see if I thought they fit. Judge every person favorably. So at first I thought, you know, well, that's we're trying, you know, judging happens, but we're not trying to judge. I mean, judging happens, but is this even relevant? But then if you think about it a little bit deeper, if you judge every person favorably, then you're not making any distinction. So you're no comparing mind, because everybody's favorable. There's no comparing there. You just judge everybody favorably. It's sort of a way of not judging in some ways. Or just really appreciating everybody. So that's another. So it's a wise thing. But you can't just do it, necessarily. But there's some wisdom there, certainly. Hillel says in Mishnah 2:4 in Pirkei Avot, do not judge your fellow till you've stood in his place. I think that's a little bit, that's relevant. That's a little bit more of a practice instruction that has something to do with what we're talking about, because really what I'm suggesting is notice when judgment arises, all these different deep qualities that happen inside of you. How there is, in fact, some greed or aversion. And if you do that kind of work, then you start to realize what it's like to be a human being. You can't. I think that's what it means to stand in somebody's shoes. You can't stand in their actual shoes. You know, it means like, okay, if you were them, what would it feel like? And the reason you can know what it might feel like is because you know what things feel like to you. So there's a sort of way that if we do this work, you can sort of get to the place that Hillel is suggesting. You can't get there until you do that kind of work. And so he doesn't say, don't judge your fellow ever. You just don't judge them until you've done this kind of work. Then once you've done this kind of work, you'll understand that they're just like you. So I want to talk now, I want to get into comparing some more, especially about comparing mind, comparing self to others. This is from Zen Mind, Beginner Mind, Beginner's Mind. By Suzuki Roshi. In our scriptures, I won't cite the thing. In your scriptures, it is said there are four kinds of horses: excellent ones, good ones, poor ones, and bad ones. The best horse will run slow and fast, right and left, at the driver's will, before it sees the shadow of the whip. The second best will run as well as the first one does, just before the whip reaches its skin. They'll do it just before the whip reaches their skin. The third one will run when it feels the pain on its body. The fourth one will run after the pain penetrates to the marrow of its bones. You can imagine how difficult it is for the fourth one to learn how to run. When we hear this story, almost all of us want to be the best horse. If it's impossible to be the best one, we want to be the second best. This is, I think, the usual understanding of this story and of Zen. You may think that when you sit in Zazen, you'll find out whether you are one of the best horses or one of the worst ones. Here, however, there is a misunderstanding of Zen. If you think the aim of Zen practice is to train you to become one of the best horses, you'll have a big problem. This is not the right understanding. If you practice Zen in the right way, it doesn't matter whether you are the best horse or the worst one. When you consider the mercy of the Buddha, how do you think the Buddha will feel about the four kinds of horses? He'll have more sympathy for the worst one than for the best one. When you are determined to practice Zazen with the great mind of Buddha, you will find the worst horse is the most valuable one. In your very imperfections, you will find the basis for your firm, way-seeking mind. Those who can sit perfectly physically usually take more time to obtain the true way of Zen, the actual feeling of Zen, the marrow of Zen. But those who find great difficulties in practicing Zen will find more meaning in it. So I think that sometimes the best horse may be the worst horse, and the worst horse can be the best one. So if you find yourself comparing yourself to the other people, or you think it's so incessant, and you know, what's the matter with you? You just have more, you have a better chance at waking up and seeing clearly. There's more things worthwhile for paying attention to. It's comparing mind is also sometimes called the conceit of self-view. So when you compare yourself to another person, and you think that you're better than that person, that's the conceit of self-view. But it's also, in the way this teaching comes across, it's also conceit when you think you're worse than somebody else. And it's also conceit when you think you're equal to them. So all three of those positions, I wrote that they're better than, equal than, worse than, all of them are sort of a conceited self-view. Now normally it's not exactly the normal way we use the word conceit, so if you look up conceit, usually it says, and I looked in the, got this from the dictionary, excessive pride in oneself, puffed up with conceit. But one of the synonyms is egotism, self-regard. So I think a better definition would be self-involved. Conceit is when you're sort of excessively self-involved. And all three of those ways are self-involved. All three kinds of comparing eventually lead to the same errors in life, which is sort of alienation from the oneness of life, alienation from other beings, because you're self-preoccupied, preoccupied with the self as separate from the one. So it's a broader, using a broader definition of conceit. So there's this story that went around meditation halls about the Dalai Lama. I remember hearing this a long time ago. So I think it was at the end of the first time that Insight Meditation Society in Berry did a 3-month retreat. That was a while ago, but the Dalai Lama happened to be in the States, and he came to the retreat, to the 3-month retreat, and gave somewhere near the end of the retreat, gave one of the closing talks near the end of the retreat. So he's talking to the students, then he did the question and answer session with the students who had just been on a retreat for a long time. And if you've seen him, you know he works with a translator. But his English is pretty good, but he does work with a translator. And so a student raises his hand and says, well, do you have any advice for working with self-hatred? And the translator, you know, translates to the Dalai Lama, and then for about 5 minutes, the Dalai Lama and the translator are talking back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And it sort of gets clear after a while that he doesn't understand the question. You know, and when he finally, you can't believe that the person is even saying that. He must not be understanding it right somehow, self-hatred. But it's out of his frame of reference. It's not a Tibetan issue, right? It's an American issue, right? It's not so. And when he finally gets it, he just says, "Oh, that's just wrong thinking. That's just wrong thinking," you know. There's a certain way, and if you think about that story, if you think about maybe yourself, if you have those kinds of feelings, maybe you notice that you know everybody else is really doing okay, and only you're the only one who's sort of, you know, not okay in this universe. That's a real conceit, right? Only you are like that. You can sort of see how that's a conceit. You know, it's hard to see it about yourself, but when you realize you don't think that about anybody else, it's sort of conceited. And then here's another quote about that, and I don't remember where I got this quote from, but I liked it a lot. Believing in your littleness is arrogant because it's believing in your own opinion rather than God's. Believing in your littleness is arrogant because it's believing in your own opinion rather than God's. I like that. I thought that was beautiful. Comparing and judging mind is often rooted in fear of not being good enough. Right? See if that's not true. Check that out for yourself. See if when you're having feelings about comparing or judging yourself and others, especially here, see if that's not part of it, not being good enough. Jack Kornfield, I hope they're just little teachings that I've heard over the time. I hope are helpful when you think about teaching. I heard Jack Kornfield once say that when he's going to give a teaching, he said if he's nervous, like if he goes in a talk and he's feeling nervous, he tells himself, "Well, there's too much Jack." If that's what he's feeling, there's too much Jack. Because the point is we're not doing this to impress anybody. The point is to give over the material. It's about the material. It's not about our ego. So if we're worried, it's because we're worried about from an ego point of view, usually. Another example from the teaching we did together, this one was Sheila and I, when we taught also a 2-year program with Sylvia Boorstein. The three of us taught together, also 4 7-day retreats. So. This is the one I was thinking when I started to do the other one, timing one. So we got to the end of that process where somebody had heard me give 8 different talks, right, over the 2 years, and heard everybody else give them, Sheila and Sylvia as well. So we're going around in the sharing at the end, and this person says, he said something to this effect. This is pretty close to what he said. He said, in the program, he felt like when he listened to me talking, it took a lot of pressure off of him because he realized that a rabbi can get up and teach and doesn't have to be perfect. You remember? I remember that. So, okay. So, what kind of thought is that?
How would you rate that? And so this comparing, you certainly comparing, you know, what he does and what I do. I mean, I did hear it as a backhanded compliment. You know, if he clearly what I said had been valuable to him, and it didn't matter if it was polished or not. And the fact that, you know, from his perspective, it wasn't polished, that did it took a lot of pressure off of him. It's not about him. It's not about me. If the material is worth hearing, that's great. So I think there was a lot of discernment in that. You know, there was comparing. I can't say I loved hearing it exactly. I mean, I had a little, okay. But I don't have bad thoughts about that person when I see them. You know? And it was the first, it was like, you know, I'd been teaching for 2 years at that point or something. It was 20 years, it was 18 years ago. It was probably pretty accurate altogether. You know, it wasn't so polished then. I don't spend a lot of time polishing my talk. I have a couple talks I decide, this one I'm going to polish. But mostly I don't do that. So, last year I taught a retreat with Sylvia Norman. And Sylvia taught the opening night, I taught the next night, so then Norman got up. And this is what Norman said. I thought it was so great. And Norman comes up with things sometimes that are just like, he said, wasn't Sylvia's talk great that first night? And it was so Sylvia. And wasn't Jeff's talk great? And it was so Jeff, you know? And when Joanna gives talks, aren't they great? But they're so Joanna, you know? And when Sheila gives talks, aren't they great? But they're so Sheila, you know? And when Jordan gives talks, they're great, but they're so Jordan, right? And they're so Jordan, you know? And that's great. That's the way it is. And that's why we have that story that we all like so much about Zusha, about Reb Zusha. You know, when Reb Zusha dies, they're not going to say to Reb Zusha, when he gets to heaven, the question is not going to be, why weren't you more like Moses? You know, the question they're going to ask him, why weren't you more like Zusha? So pay attention here. This is a really good thing that popped into my head. Being yourself is not problematic in the way that comparing yourself is. Being yourself is not problematic in the way that comparing yourself is, comparing yourself to others. Isn't that an interesting distinction for us? Comparing yourself to others separates you from the one. Being yourself allows the possibility of completely giving yourself over to the one, because no one but you can make the unique contribution to the whole of life, and that's your purpose for being. So being yourself is not a problem whatsoever, but comparing is. You're really different. And being yourself is not trying to become. You're not trying to become anything special. I'm now going to leave out the second half of the talk. And that's after I cut out the third half of the talk earlier. But if you're preparing talks, I actually wrote notes. Okay, skip this, skip that. If you need to, skip this, skip this, skip to here. So that's a good thing to prepare. And when I used to do these talks too, I would say everything I had to say, and then I would just stop talking. You know, I forgot what I learned in fifth grade, that an essay has to have an introduction, a middle, and a conclusion. Right? So I just gotta turn a lot of pages to get to the conclusion. So what did I learn? What did I learn from practicing and writing this talk? I wrote this talk about 2 weeks into a two-week retreat that I was teaching. So I did this. I watched my mind do these comparing and judging. So, I used, in essence, I'd recommend this. You use comparing and judgmental mind as a mindfulness bell. Like whenever you see it go off, like, oh, ding, pay attention. So I did it a lot. I mean, I was just, you know, I was more or less sort of tracking all my thoughts. Like I did a retreat with Ujjanika, where Sayadaw Ujjanika was an Eastern teacher, and he was the first key practice instruction is, when you sit, are you aware of every single thought you have? Every single thought. So in essence, we're trying to do this. Otherwise, you're asleep, basically, to most of them. So I paid attention to sort of lots of thoughts. I was really paying attention to lots of thoughts. And, you know, I actually learned there was a lot more judgmental and comparing than I realized. You know, it was coming up all the time. Because mostly I ignore it. Mostly there's the A. Mostly have an A average. I think mostly you probably have an A average, but I don't know. I'm not inside. Most of those thoughts, I don't notice them. I didn't know how much that was going on. I don't actually think of myself as a very judgmental person, but if I track the thoughts, there are certainly a lot of them. So that was the first thing I saw. I just saw how many there were. And it was okay. I felt like, wow, it's really, really interesting. So there's a lot more than I thought. With this practice, we're cultivating, this D-average, this discerning. We can get to this place of discerning. So that's a D-average. But then I realized we can be working to get an F instead. So the F starts when you start with forgiveness. So you notice all these things arising. Oh, judgment. Oh, you know, comparing. Oh, not good enough. Okay. So you start, the F comes in, and you start, you forgive yourself. Whatever is arising, whatever thoughts are arising, it's arising because of causes and conditions. So you want to forgive yourself about it. You want to recognize that you're paying attention to the mind. You're not paying attention to your mind, really. This is just the mind. It's not your mind. This is the way the mind works. So you want to forgive yourself for your judgments. You want to be compassionate for your judgments. You want to put your hands on your heart and say, you know, I care about my suffering. Okay, I see how that works. So we get that to that F. Don't take it too personally. And when you do all of that, when you have discernment about what's arising in your mind, you also get an F for freedom. Because you become free of the unconscious holds over you that these other states have when you're not paying attention. And the A of asleep becomes the A of awake. How could anyone ever tell you were anything less than beautiful? How could anyone ever tell you were less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that your teaching is a miracle? How deeply you're connected to my soul. How could anyone ever tell you were anything less than beautiful? How could anyone ever tell you you were less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that your loving is a miracle? How deeply you're connected to my soul. I got my song in. Well, let's just sit for a moment, for a minute in silence.